Okay, good morning. I am definitely not too tall for the mic, so you'll have no problem hearing me. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what is the state of the science for screening for sexually transmitted infections and some of the reason that we are not doing so well in areas that we should be doing better at. And so I do have a financial disclosure. I do work for Activist Pharmaceuticals as a consultant. I know, public health person in the pharmaceutical world. I'm sorry about that. But Activist had no role in this presentation whatsoever. So sexually transmitted infections, what do we know? So we do know they're a major public health concern. That's a definite. They're a significant cause of morbidity in this country and even for some people mortality. And adolescents and young adults between the ages of 15 and 25 bear the greatest burden for these diseases. Annual costs in the United States exceed $15 billion for testing, treatment, rescreening. And many viral sexually transmitted infections, specifically HPV and HSV, are not reportable to local health departments. And so actual estimations of disease rates vary and are difficult to come up with. So what contributes to these really, really high rates? So these are not going to be shocking. Access to health care, or more importantly, lack of access to health care. And as the Affordable Care Act starts to roll out more in the next couple of years, hopefully we'll start to see more people gaining access to the health care system that previously couldn't access it. Health care disparities are a huge factor. Political factors in this country, we make a big political deal about sex and who should have it and who they should have it with. So conservative political groups have a hand in this as well. This secrecy and stigma that goes along with sex in this country, substance abuse, mental illness, and then partner concurrency. So you have a partner that has multiple partners, or you also have multiple partners along with your regular partner as well. But we do have some best practices for comprehensive care surrounding sexual activity and sexually transmitted infections, and the CDC has outlined these. And they include education and counseling, because we never want to treat someone without educating and counseling them for anything. Identification, screening, and treatment of asymptomatic individuals, because we know a lot of sexually transmitted infections actually don't have any symptoms, and that's when they get passed most frequently. Diagnosis, treatment, and counseling of infected individuals. We want to get them treated quickly and get their partner treated. And partner identification and management. So we need to be able to find that partner or partners to try to break that cycle of passing it on. And then also primary prevention, so pre-exposure vaccination for the vaccine-preventable STIs that exist, and that's currently hepatitis B and HPV. And we know that the HPV vaccination rates in this country really are abysmal. So what are our current screening guidelines? Because we do have some evidence for who we should screen currently and when. So for chlamydia, all sexually active women 25 and under should be screened for chlamydia every single year, regardless of their zip code, their occupation, their marital status, and who they say their partner is, blanketly every single year. For women over 25, you screen based on risk factors. For gonorrhea, we have targeted screening for sexually active women 25 and under, and for those at risk. So what makes you at risk, and what is a risk factor? Well, there's multiple ones. So it could be that you have a new sexual partner. It could be that you have multiple other partners. You have a history of previous STIs, or you are currently diagnosed with a different STI. Inconsistent or absent condom use, commercial sex work, substance abuse. And also all women who are pregnant should be screened for gonorrhea and chlamydia on their first visit, again, regardless of marital status, zip code, occupation. We also should retest for gonorrhea and chlamydia because we know that a past infection is the strongest predictor of a repeat infection, especially among young women in this 25 and under age group. And an untreated partner is the primary source of reinfection for women. It's not that the antibiotics don't work, and it's not that people don't take them. It's that they have a partner that doesn't get treated quickly, doesn't get treated at all, can't access the healthcare system, and then they just end up getting reinfected. So individuals that have a positive gonorrhea or chlamydia test should be retested within 3 months. And the reason for this is that for repeat infections in women raise the risk of PID and infertility. So, you know, how are we doing with that screening? Not so great. So it's estimated that between 25 and up to 50% of women who are under 25 are actually not screened annually for chlamydia, and that women over 25 are screened too much when they actually fall into a much lower risk group. So this little bar here that's circled, that's the group that has the highest rates of chlamydia. It's your 15 to 25. That's the group that's not being screened. And then this group, as you start to fall off over here, are the ones that are being screened too much. So we know chlamydia and gonorrhea are not the only STIs in the world. They're the ones that people hear about the most, but there are other ones as well. So what do you do about those? How do you screen for things that are not chlamydia and gonorrhea? So screening is based on patient history, patient concerns, exam findings, and then your own clinical judgment. And what I see a lot in clinical practice is the I want to be tested for everything, and to which I say, well, what's everything to you? And they're like, well, I don't know. Just test me for it. So that you get into kind of a sticky spot with that because we don't have the resources to test people for everything under the sun. We should test based on what their risk factors are. We do know that HIV testing should be offered to all patients that are seeking testing for sexually transmitted infections, and we should be incorporating that into regular primary health care visits. We should vaccinate as primary prevention, because primary prevention is always better than secondary. And then our pap smear screening should be per national guidelines, because cervical cancer really is the result of an infection with a sexually transmitted infection. And so as we've talked a lot about in this meeting, geography matters, right? And if you were at the opening session yesterday, you heard about how Louisiana is not doing so well with their national health rankings. Well, this is one of the areas that they're not doing so well in. So the very, very darkest areas down here in the very dark sort of crimson red have the highest rates of all STIs per their residents. And you can see it's the southern states really do bear the burden of that, Louisiana, one of them. And then the very, very light pink up in the northwest and then up in the northeast have some of the lowest rates of STIs. And that goes to healthcare disparities, to poverty, to access to healthcare as well. So geography definitely does matter. And then there are some special populations in terms of screening for STIs that we need to consider, and men who have sex with men is one of those populations. And so the rates of certain STIs are on the rise in this group, more so than any other, HIV, syphilis, and gonorrhea. And this was really the group that at the height of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s really was at the forefront of lowering HIV rates and safer sex and condom use, and now it's the group that's actually suffering from rising rates of STIs. And so there are some potential contributing factors. One is a trend in viewing HIV as a chronic illness and not a fatal disease, which is actually a really, really good thing. People with HIV are living a long time, and they're living, for the most part, a good, healthy life if they have access to medication. But what that does is that they're not sick. And they're out and they're about and they're in relationships, and HIV is not seen so much as that death sentence that it once was. There's a rise in methamphetamine and club drug use among men who have sex with men, and also recreational use of PDE5 inhibitors as well. You know, Cialis and Viagra, which goes along with the club drug use, and then also change in sex partner networks. So this is a group that now finds their partners a lot of times on the internet, by mobile app, and easy to find, you know, quick kind of anonymous partners for sex. So we have some special considerations for this population. It is recommended that they be screened annually for HIV, syphilis, and then urethral, rectal, and pharyngeal, either gonorrhea or chlamydia, depending upon what type of intercourse that they engage in. And they can be tested more frequently based on sexual behaviors and risk factors. And I have some patients that are tested every 2 months that they just come in on a standing basis. So if we have all these recommendations and we know who should be screened and why should they be screened and when, why are people not being screened, right? So that's sort of like the million-dollar question. So there are a lot of issues. So there's provider-level issues. So one is failure to perform an adequate sexual history, which I'll talk about in a minute. Also, this linking of STI screening to pap smears and pelvic exams for women. So we're not doing so many pelvic exams on women anymore. There's a lot of controversy about what is the actual predictive value of finding disease on a yearly pelvic exam. We're not doing them routinely in women that are under the age of 21, and we're really lengthening out the time in between pap smears as well. So if you, in your mind as a provider, are linking STI testing to those two specific events, there are times where people can definitely fall through the cracks in the system. And then there's also provider bias and lack of training as well. And then there's some systems issues, lack of access, lack of insurance, lack of providers to find care with, this stigma, and there's definitely concern about confidentiality for a lot of patients. So how do we increase evidence-based screening? So awareness of what the current screening guidelines are, and right now we're still working off the 2010 STD screening guidelines from the CDC. The 2004 guidelines are coming out momentarily, apparently. But they don't have a whole lot of difference in terms of screening. They do have a few little tweaks in them in terms of treatment. But also remember the partner and consider sort of flexible accommodations for treating the partner. You know, BYOMP, we do that in my clinic, bring your own partner. Doesn't matter if your partner is a patient in our clinic. Just bring them along with you. We'll treat your partner all at the same time. We'll quickly get your partner in the system and we'll get them treated. But there's a lot of resistance to that, and there's a lot of reasons that people can't be flexible like that in their existing healthcare system. And then there's expedited partner therapy where the partner's treated sight unseen. You don't even necessarily lay eyes on them. But expedited partner therapy is not legal in all states. The green states do support it, and there's wording and legislation that protects healthcare providers if something goes wrong. And what goes wrong most often is an allergic reaction by someone that you prescribe antibiotics to. But there are some states where it's not supported, and if there was a side effect or an untoward outcome, that provider could be held liable for providing medication and care to someone that they had not had a relationship with previously. So there are some challenges to EPT. So probably one of the biggest take-homes here is the importance of taking a really good and accurate sexual history, because it guides conversations about testing and it helps to estimate risks for specific STIs that someone may be at risk for. And it's not this blanket one size fits all test me for everything. It's test me for what really I might be at risk for. And it also allows for individualized education that's tailored to specific behaviors. So the patient doesn't get this canned, use condoms, don't have a lot of partners, don't use drugs before you have sex, kind of blanket lecture that might not necessarily apply to them. And then taking a good sexual history acknowledges pregnancy prevention as well, because we know half of all pregnancies in the United States are unplanned. So there are 5 P's of taking a sexual history: it's partners, pregnancy prevention, protection from STIs, what your specific sexual practices are, and a past history of STIs. I know those questions are kind of small and hard to see, but if you kind of hit all of those points, you will really know in the end what your patient really is at risk for based on what they do and who they do it with. So take-home messages, enhanced awareness and improved screening, really, really important for early identification of STIs and early treatment. You have to know your patient population and you have to know your population-specific risks. So where do you provide care? Are you in one of those states that is in the really dark red? Are you in one of those states that's in the light pink? Because it really will help to kind of direct your care. Remember, there is a partner involved in this. It didn't happen by itself, so there's someone else that you've got to think about in all of this, even if they're not in your practice. Taking an accurate sexual history is really key. And then non-judgmental education and counseling. We definitely don't want to moralize this. These are just some really, really great online resources and some training that you can do if you're not too good at taking a sexual history, because it does take a while to get that language down. And I thank you very much.